Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We're still on the road and hence have our mobile studio. We're very pleased to be catching up in that studio, however, with our friend George Raceley, this program's duty genius, I'm fond of saying, Mensa member, as well as just an extraordinary resource on all matters political, the product in part of his time working in the office of the vice president, also on Capitol Hill, now with the marvelous newsletter published by Richard Viguerie entitled Conservative HQ. He has been involved with some 300 political campaigns, and that includes several at the presidential level. And we're especially pleased to be able to talk with him a little bit about an issue that has arisen rather dramatically, I think it's fair to say, in the now ongoing presidential sweepstakes for 2024. George Raceley, it's so good to have you with us as always. Welcome to Axer.
Thank you for having me back, Frank.
It's a pleasure. Let me start by asking you about this indictment of Donald Trump again, this time by a special prosecutor for federal crimes he is alleged to have engaged in involving classified material, its handling, storage, and efforts to conceal that he had such documents. What do you make of this, George, both in terms of the merits of the case? As I recall, you're a trained attorney, though I don't know if you practiced as one, but also that you've been closely studying the effort to vilify, yes, and otherwise, you know, silence and marginalize, if not actually imprison, the former president of the United States, our 45th president, Donald J. Trump.
Yeah, well, as an untrained attendee at law school, not an attorney, I have to say that you know, having worked at the White House, if someone told me that President Bush could not keep the products of the President's Council on Competitiveness, which was part of the executive office of the president, some of that material being of a classified nature, I would have laughed them out of the room and escorted them outside the fine iron fence that surrounds the White House because I figured they were crazy. But here we see the Biden administration essentially distorting the Espionage Act to try and jail President Trump for up to 100 years if he was sentenced to the max on all the charges. And I mean, this is unbelievable. I mean, we're turning the United States into something like Pakistan or Guatemala or Peru, where
the proverbial banana republic.
Yeah, I mean,
but George, it's made all the more not just absurd, but outrageous, is it not, by the blind eye that the administration's Justice Department seems to be turning to crimes that are even more palpable, it seems, and more obvious to even the layperson.
Yeah.
In which the president of the United States at the moment, Joe Biden, has engaged in over quite a period of time, going back to his time in the Senate, as I understand.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a growing body of evidence that Biden accepted bribes or that he was constructively bribed, if you will, by payments to his family members. And that is on the four corners of the Bribery Act, by the way.
I wasn't even going there. That's another topic. But just on the election, the question of the handling or mishandling of classified information illegally taken by a guy who didn't have the authority to declassify anything at the time.
Yeah,
the president, let alone senator.
Yes, a senator and a vice president have no declassification authority whatsoever, and they're not entitled to retain material of that nature. You know, as a senator, it would seem that most of the stuff that he would have accessed as chairman of foreign affairs should have been in a skiff. I mean, it's not something that you can have floating around a relatively unsecure Senate office where, you know, any intern or visitor can, particularly back in the early days when Biden was in the Senate, you know, any Tom, Dick, and Harry could pretty well walk in there.
Well, to say nothing of his garage with his beloved Corvette.
Yeah.
But George, let me just ask you this, because it seems as though there are two particularly important takeaways from all of this. And one is the seeming double standard to which Donald Trump, and for that matter, others who happen to be on the Republican side of the aisle, more or less, have been subjected. What that means for our country, the foundation of which arguably is equal justice under the law. Point one, and point two, the extent to which, as is so often the case with the left, they're trying to use projection to obscure their own conduct, some of it very dangerous to the national security of the United States.
Yeah, example. Well, you know, anytime we raise these topics, why the left always accuses us of whataboutism. But, you know, the reality is that it is undeniable there are two standards of justice. And the, you know, the Democratic Party has, as I've said before, turned into a sort of witness protection program for the Bidens and the Clintons, in which their crimes are obscured, not prosecuted, covered up, narratives run against them. And, you know, the news media gets a memo from the DNC, don't cover this. And suddenly, boom, it disappears from the front pages and the lead signals, lead segments on TV.
Whereas, if it's what they're projecting you onto, Donald Trump or any of his subordinates or friends, for that matter, it's front page news 24/7, and the false narratives, usually false narratives, are propounded. George, I did want to ask you about one other thing before we have to take a short break, and that is another perturbation in the force, if you will, on the Republican side of the aisle, and that is the handling, or one might simply say mishandling, of the debt ceiling negotiations between Speaker McCarthy and President Biden and his team. Has caused a very considerable upset within at least some in the ranks of the Republican caucus in the House, most especially, and I think the base more generally.
Oh, yeah.
Your thoughts on how that stands, and does it likely impact the future tenure of the Speaker of the House?
Well, it's a good question whether somebody will actually, you know, call a vote of, in essence, no confidence to vacate the chair. But I think more practically, the 20 or so members who voted against, Republican members who voted against the debt ceiling rule have kind of, have declared their freedom. And they're no longer bound by requests from leadership to vote for unpalatable legislation, and I think McCarthy is...
Or even palatable legislation. They just seem to be saying, you know, it's not going to be business as usual with this speaker at this point.
Yeah, and so that renders McCarthy's tenure as speaker potentially, you know, frozen with nothing moving in the House. And it remains to be seen whether some kind of, you know, modus vivendi can be constructed there. But right now...
Hold the thought, George. I want to come back on that very point. We'll be speaking more with George Raisley, the editor-in-chief of Conservative HQ, right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Freedom is an endangered species thanks to the Chinese Communist Party's so-called social credit system. It utilizes a comprehensive array of advanced surveillance, computing, and artificial intelligence technologies to monitor and control its own population. Worse yet, the Chinese Communists and their globalist allies at the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, Big Pharma, and of course, the Biden administration, seek to impose this digital gulag here and throughout the world. The building blocks of that liberty-crushing project include Team Biden's bid to institutionalize the China model of pandemic lockdowns, emergency orders, and mandates, American businesses conforming to environment, social, and governance scoring, and the proliferation of global and national health IDs. The time to resist is now, while we still can. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We are speaking with George Raceley, one of our favorite guests, and as I'm fond of saying, duty geniuses. He is an ideas man, first and foremost, with a lot of experience in the political world. And we're always interested in his take on developments in Washington. And we were speaking before the break, George, about the upset a great many Republicans feel, not just the 29 that voted against this debt ceiling outcome, but I think an enormous number in the base who feel once again that their leadership is betraying them. You mentioned that there's at the moment, a sort of Mexican standoff, if I can use that expression, between those disaffected representing the disaffected in the base on the one hand and McCarthy and his loyalists. That is sufficiently serious that it is basically preventing legislation from being taken up in the House unless and until the dissidents are somehow satisfied that it is going to be not business as usual, but business along the lines of what the Speaker promised to become Speaker. You said there might be a modus vivendi, way of getting past all of this. What are your thoughts on the prospects of that? And is that?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Frank, because traditionally, the way that leadership resolved these things was to go to the members and say, okay, you know, what do you want? What's going to take you to get back on board? And it would be, oh, well, I need two stoplights in my district, and then I'll be happy to vote for all this, you know, non-conservative stuff. Well, most of those 29 don't want anything other than good government and a return to the, you know, the America that we knew and loved in the Reagan era when you and I were, active in D.C., and so, yeah, when men were men. And so it'll be interesting because, you know, you basically can't bribe most of these guys with pork, which is the way that it's always been done in the past.
Yeah. So to the extent that bribery is not an option, these folks presumably have to at minimum be satisfied that the deal that they struck earlier that got Kevin McCarthy the gavel will be honored again, having been breached.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean,
the question is how much of a run do they give him before somebody does? And it only takes one, insist on so-called vacation of the chair. And George, you understand, you know, the House representative and its rules far better than I. What happens if somebody does, like Mark Meadows with John Boehner a few years back, call for this action to be taken? What are the mechanics going?
Well, as I understand it, a privileged motion, which means pretty much everything comes to a halt, and the House has to take it up. There's debate. And they vote. And of course, the interesting thing would then be, would the Democrats vote to keep McCarthy in the chair?
They voted effectively to help him out.
They did indeed.
Do take pork, but also presumably other pounds of flesh from him in the process
Absolutely.
Of doing the deal on this debt ceiling business. Very much to their liking, by the way, to the extent that the Republican base is horrified, it's in part because the Democrats found it to be such a, I mean, not least the idea that there's no limit on how much debt they can run up between now and 2025, which is just a staggeringly bad outcome, needless to say. George, I did want to turn to one other bad outcome that is being aggressively pursued by the Biden administration. That is the idea of surrendering our sovereignty to actually not just the World Health Organization, but first and foremost, perhaps that one that is, if they have their way, going to be entrusted with the authority to tell us when we have a public health emergency of international concern, as it's called, and what we will do about it. This is such an extraordinary affront to, you know, both the personal as well as national sovereignty of Americans that I just am struck that this could even be going on, but it's going on with very little attention being paid apart from a handful of some 20 members of the House of Representatives so far. Your thoughts on what's going on, its implications, and what we best
Well, it's important for your audience to recognize that the surrender of American sovereignty is an essential plank of the Democrat platform. And we see it at our southern border, you know, where actual members of the United States military were opening gates to let illegal aliens in. We see it in this WHO treaty or non-treaty, as the Biden administration is trying to frame it. It's just a deal or an agreement or a contract. It's not a treaty.
An accord.
According to them.
And then there are these amendments to the international health regulations as well.
And so it would allow WHO to create these digital health passports. It would allow them to essentially declare anything that's happening in America that they don't like as a health emergency. So suddenly gun control can be a health emergency because, you know, according to the left, we have a murder epidemic.
It's the narrative. And conceivably, you could have them ordering us to respond to that gun violence crisis by confiscating things like the firearm displayed prominently behind you as a proud member and instructor of the NRA, the National Rifle Association. George, again, you'd think that this would be the kind of thing that members of Congress, certainly members of the United States Senate, would be seized with. And yet the Senate, not so long ago, actually voted not to do its duty and consider whatever agreements come out of this World Health Organization negotiation. Am I missing something here, sir?
No, you are not. And it's inconceivable to me, having worked for two prominent senators, that the Senate as an institution would give up its prerogatives. I mean, that's kind of an essential part of our checks and balances in the Constitution, is the notion that the various arms of our government will act to retain the prerogatives that the Constitution grants them. And the Senate, you know, has in several instances, certainly in you know, my time in politics, given up crucial elements of its prerogatives to ratify treaties in particular.
Well, and you know, deferring to the administrative state, all kinds of authorities that used to be legislative powers. But on this treaty business, George, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I would argue that it was one of the most important of the elements of the checks and balances arrangements, because the founders clearly understood that international agreements could, as with these present undertakings, so dramatically change the character of our government as to be, you know, not just transformative, but, you know, destructive of our constitutional republic. And that they therefore set the bar very high, not only gave the Senate the power to ratify any treaty, but also to establish that it passed muster with at least 2/3 of the Senate and the supermajority. That is now completely over the side. You mentioned other agreements. Yeah. The Iran nuclear agreement is another example. And we have to leave it at this, I'm afraid. We will lose our country if we do not stop what the Biden administration is doing now with the help of the Chinese communists and others to have global governance imposed upon us without the Senate's advice and consent. George Raisley, thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us soon. All of these topics are so important. We appreciate your insights. We'll be right back with more.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back to Securing America. I'm Frank Affney, and we are on the road and delighted to catch up with one of our regulars about this time each week, and that would be Bill Walton, a former master of the universe on Wall Street with Allied Capital, a $6 billion operation, and as well as a leader of the conservative movement in the United States as a past president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm very proud to be a member. Bill is the host of The Bill Walton Show, his own television program, which you can find, among other places, at CPAC.com. He is a good friend and always a valued contributor to these programs. We're delighted to catch up with him once again. Bill, glad to have you back.
Frank, good to see you.
You were kind enough, Bill, recently to produce one of your television podcasts about our new book, The Indictment.
Terrific show. We put it up on CPAC last week.
Great. And I'm so appreciative of you doing so. The main thrust of that book, if I could distill it down to one essential point, is it's not just the Chinese Communist Party that is a mortal enemy of the United States. We have to look very, very hard at the enablers of the CCP, as it's called, here in the United States. And quite a number of them, I think probably pound for pound, the most important of them are your former colleagues on Wall Street who have been aiding and abetting the Chinese, among other things, by migrating funds on some very large scale to communist China. I want to talk to you about several different pieces of this, but maybe we could start with a related point, which is that Robert Kennedy Jr. has entered the political fray in the role of a challenger for the Democratic nomination to President Biden. He has of late been most known and celebrated, I think properly so, for his work against these very dangerous vaccines that many Americans were induced to take to try to protect themselves against COVID-19's virus, the so-called SARS-CoV-2 virus. Bill, talk a little bit about this candidate and in particular what he is saying about China that is, well, deeply troubling, it seems to me.
Well, a lot of us have begun to like Bobby Kennedy Jr. because we liked what he was saying about the vaccine and the big drug companies, and he's spot on in that. He's a very troubling position on climate, which is a big problem for me. But I didn't know what his thoughts were on China until just in the past week, he appeared on, of all people, Elon Musk's podcast talking about China. And in that podcast, he said basically the Chinese cannot and do not want to compete with us militarily. The United States should be de-escalating military pressure on China. And he said, you know, we think the world's on our side, but it isn't. The rest of the world's with us, and they think China, in effect, is just fine. Well, this was really a jaw-dropping moment, you know, because when he said not many people are on our side with China, he sort of forgot that its closest neighbors, Australia, New Zealand, Korea, Japan, are all incredibly alarmed about China and begin raising their defense budgets, because the fact is China's become the world's world's largest navy in order to dominate the China seas, and space warfare, they're investing big time there. And that Kennedy wouldn't know this is really naive in the extreme. Now, the context...
And disqualifying, would you say?
Utterly. Utterly. I mean, if he thinks about the Chinese, he's quoted here as saying they don't want war, they want peace, and they want prosperity. Well, I think he hasn't been paying the slightest attention to what President Xi has been saying and doing, and all the other signals that you and I and the rest of us have been monitoring.
The thing that's also concerning, Bill, of course, as you know, is that this would have been music to the ears of Elon Musk, as best we can tell, who has thrown in with the Chinese Communist Party to such an extraordinary degree that some say he's wholly owned by them. Your thoughts?
I know you often get annoyed with me, Frank, because I tend to know what these business people and investors are thinking about, and it's not very patriotic. They're in it primarily for the money. Most of the investors in China from outside China just wish this whole geopolitical thing would go away so they could get back into making money there. Well, you know, I think Xi has
the efficiencies of the Chinese system.
The efficiencies, right? Who was that? That
like
was
slave
Obama.
Labor.
We digress. But the Elon Musk was just last week in China, maybe 2 weeks ago, and he is a rock star in China. I mean, he was feted, celebrated, dinners at 16-course five-star restaurants. And, you know, of course, Tesla is quite big in China. They sell a lot of cars there. Their batteries are made there and a lot of the essential components. And so Musk is an interesting sort of exhibit A for the conflicts, because if you think the climate agenda is really about the climate industrial complex, and that the agenda is a lot deeper and not necessarily about saving the planet for people, then Musk is on the wrong side of that one. And of course, when he's talking with Kennedy and Kennedy's saying, oh, the problem with the Chinese is that we're not treating them nicely enough, and that we need to make peace with them in order to, you know, we're the problem, he's saying. Chinese love that. And that the fact that he's saying on Elon's show sends signals that are exactly the signals Musk wants to send.
Yeah, and Barry.
And I like him, but he's playing a dangerous game.
Let me ask you, Bill, about another example of this sort of financial sector compromise, elite capture, as the Chinese call it. And that would be the role played, as we talked a little bit about last week, by a fellow by the name of Neil Shen, one of the founders of Sequoia Capital and the driving force behind its China arm, appropriately enough, as he seems to be working for China. Our colleague and friend Steve Bannon and Bob Costello have been talking about this with Derek Harvey, among others, of late. You've had a chance to do a little bit more research into this outfit and the implications of what Chen in particular has been up to.
Well, as I pointed out last week, this is not exactly breaking news. I mean, Sequoia was founded in, I think, the 60s or 70s by Don Valentine, who's one of the Hall of Fame venture capitalists. And Sequoia has been active in Silicon Valley, of course, but in the last 20 years, they set up two funds that are acting basically standalone, one in India and the other one in China. And the one in China was set up in 2005, headed up by Neil Chen. And Neil Chen, talking about rock stars, is another rock star in China. He's celebrated as the top Chinese investor. And he also has been named the number one venture capitalist 4 years in a row by Forbes magazine. And
Costello says that you don't have that kind of luck without somebody actually putting their fingers on the scale.
Well, the thing about venture capital in China is everybody's playing a probabilities game. And it turns out the Chinese Communist Party favors companies that have been very successful at stealing American or international intellectual property, and they treat those companies better. And I don't know whether Neil Chen's actually a member of the Communist Party or is just closely related to, but it's an insider's game. And so what the Sequoia decided to do, facing up to the reality of the increasing tension with China and the United States and the rest of the world, is they're basically breaking Sequoia back up into three parts, the U.S. and the rest of the world. China is one piece, and then India is another piece. And the practical reason for this is that they want to be able to invest in Chinese companies without the interference of the U.S. government. And, you know, China, Sequoia in China, is one of the largest investors in ByteDance, which, as we know, owns TikTok.
And among other
And
so operations in China. Yeah, you're exactly
and,
right.
And so the bright floodlights of fame are about to be shown on Sequoia, and they conveniently broke themselves into three pieces to, I think, deflect that. And, you know, the Biden administration, of all people, are beginning to look at screening investments out from us, from the United States into China, something we've never done before. And that would be extremely helpful to understand where our dollars are going. Derek Scissors at AEI has calculated that almost $800 billion is going into China in the last 4 or 5 years, and that we don't know what it went into. We have no way of tracking. And so we're beginning to look at that.
My guess is it's considerably larger sum over the period since Joe Biden helped negotiate a sweetheart deal for Chinese investment off of Wall Street. But Bill, I did want to hit one other thing before we have to let you go, and that is apparently Goldman Sachs is now beginning to say to the world, you know, we're not going to be trying to encourage investment in China at this point. Is that correct? And is there a reason for it that ought to be affecting us on a broader scale?
The woman who runs the Goldman Sachs private equity fund, which is investing in pension dollars and investment funds, institutional investment money in their private equity business, has stopped seeking investors in the United States because, you know, we may decry the motivations of institutional investors, but they're not stupid. And I think they understand that investments in China, as you and I've talked about, you know, could likely go to zero. And so just from both a patriotic standpoint, but maybe more what they're thinking about as an investment standpoint, China's rapidly becoming uninvestable.
It should be for both considerations, Bill. I think thank you for your insights on all of these matters, and come back to us again with them again next week, if you would. Okay. Carolyn Glick is up next with some very troubling information out of Israel. Stay tuned for more right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Freedom is an endangered species thanks to the Chinese Communist Party's so-called social credit system. It utilizes a comprehensive array of advanced surveillance, computing, and artificial intelligence technologies to monitor and control its own population. Worse yet, the Chinese Communists and their globalist allies at the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, Big Pharma, and of course, the Biden administration, seek to impose this digital gulag here and throughout the world. The building blocks of that liberty-crushing project include Team Biden's bid to institutionalize the China model of pandemic lockdowns, emergency orders, and mandates, American businesses conforming to environment, social, and governance scoring, and the proliferation of global and national health IDs. The time to resist is now, while we still can. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and I'm very pleased to say, always, when I can announce that we have the great Carolyn Glick in the house virtually. She is, of course, an extraordinary analyst and commentator and, well, contributor to the public policy debate in both Israel and in this country when it comes to matters involving the Middle East and specifically our interests there and, well, in the fate of the Jewish people. She has originally come from Chicago, Illinois. She is a Harvard-trained, expert on all of these matters, a woman who served with Benjamin Netanyahu while she was in the Israel Defense Forces after she made Aliyah to Israel. And she is a contributing, columnist to the Jewish News Service and the Carolyn Glick podcast, Carolyn Glick Show, I think it's called, as well as the author of a number of important books, including Shackled Warrior and the Israel Solution. Carolyn, I could go on, but I won't have time to interview you if I do. Thank you for joining us. It's always great to have you with us, a senior fellow at our Center for Security Policy and a dear friend. Good to have you, ma'am.
Oh, it's always great to be on your program. Thanks for having me on, Frank.
Thank you. Carolyn, you just wrote a really brilliant piece that's extraordinarily distressing about the state of affairs within the body politic of Israel. And I'd like to start, if we could, by talking a little bit about how we got to this pass, but really, where is the Jewish state at the moment in terms of, what some seem to be calling for in terms of civil war?
Well, thanks for that question. You know, we have a situation that parallels what happened in the United States in 2020, almost one-to-one in so many different respects. And one of them is that we have a very entitled, very privileged ruling class here in Israel. That's very homogeneous ethnically and socioeconomically. And they are very, very upset that they lost power in our November 1st elections. And so they determined already before the elections took place, when they saw from their own polling that they were about to lose and lose in a very fundamental way, that what they had to do was turn the country on fire. And they began planning an insurrection even before Prime Minister Netanyahu formed his coalition and his government was sworn in. They already had the organizational structure and they had the financing down to have what they build as the largest, and I think they're right, the largest campaign of nationwide protests and really mayhem that we've ever seen in Israel. And they, in this case, our two former prime ministers, Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert. And Ehud Barak is also a former chief of staff of the Israel Defense Force. And they're joined by two other former chiefs of staff of the IDF, Moshe Ya'alon and Dan Chalutz, And by some very, very wealthy high-tech billionaires and admin, the top advertising executives in Israel. And they've put together this campaign that combines what they claim is a mass protest over democracy, but really what they want to do is overturn democracy, and what they call direct action, which is acts of assault, you know, assault, battery, intimidation, browbeating of members of the government, members of ministers in the government, chairmen of key committees in the Knesset, terrorizing them, terrorizing their families. And so that's what's really been happening.
Much worse as well. And threats of much worse as well. I mean,
threats of civil war.
Assassination and civil war and so on. There, you made mention of black flags. And this does seem so reminiscent of the playbook that the Antifa and Black Lives Matter folks used with, I think, the pretty overt support of the Democrats in the United States as well.
President Biden himself.
Yeah, well, at the time...
President Biden himself has come out in support of this. Ambassador Nides is sort of the unofficial head of the protests against the government. And yeah, I mean, I think that the parallels between the black flags that you saw in the United States and what we're experiencing here is graphic, because I mean, they even have the same symbol. They're the symbol of their quote unquote resistance, and they call themselves a resistance, just as the Democrats did after Trump was inaugurated in 2021, is a clenched fist. And the same, and it really is, like, you look at the Antifa or the Black Lives Matter symbolism, and the symbolism that's been adopted here by our elites, as they've been inciting significant swaths of the public to revolt against the government and against its intellectual supporters and against its voters, it's almost one-to-one the same as what you've seen in the United States, what you saw in the summer of 2020, and really what you've seen all along since Donald Trump won the elections in November of 2016.
And what's so alarming about this, Carolyn, is that the United States seems to be encouraging it, the government of the United States, that is. And it's happening at a time where it is hard to overstate the importance of Israel being unified and focused on enemies, especially the Republic, Islamic Republic of Iran, as they call themselves, and the danger that that poses to, well, to Israel most immediately, of course, but to all of us, I think it's fair to say. And I'm just very, very concerned that our government is exacerbating this security crisis in Israel at the same time that it seems to want Israel to be distracted and failing to act against an Iran that has now breached its red lines about nuclear capabilities. We've got about a minute before a short break. Hit it.
So what I can tell you here is that the United States is absolutely supporting what's happening here. They're empowering the Iranians to essentially go nuclear. They just transferred $3 billion in assistance to the Iranians through frozen funds from Iraq. And yes, the United States is interested in seeing this. But at the same time, Prime Minister Netanyahu was able to do a show of unity and force in the mini campaign that we ran against the Islamic Jihad in Gaza. And I think that
we have to come back on this very point of what Benjamin Netanyahu is doing and must do next. We'll be right back with Carolyn Click right after this. We're back, and we're continuing a conversation with our senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, Carolyn Glick, a woman of many parts and very, very thoughtful analyst of the security situation in the Middle East, especially that is evolving in Israel at the moment. And Carolyn, I had to interrupt you, and I apologize. Finish your thought about both what is the threat we face at a time when Israel needs to be focused on Iran and what Benjamin Netanyahu has been doing despite the assaults on his government, both extra-legal and those from, you know, the opposition, the Supreme Court, and the like.
Look, I think that, you know, what I was saying before we had to go for a break was just that the Biden administration is very openly siding with the left against the government in its efforts to overthrow the government, to paralyze the government, etc. And we had, I think, a very important demonstration of unity of purpose, at least between the government and the IDF, last month in sort of a mini campaign that Israel waged against Islamic Jihad terrorists controlled by Iran in the Gaza Strip. And so I think one of the important things, of course, was the damage that Israel did to that particular terrorist organization during the course of the campaign. But the other thing that was very important was that it had sent an incredibly important signal to Iran and to Hezbollah, which is Iran's terrorist organization that controls Lebanon, which is that, you know, with all of the domestic strife that we're facing and with all of the hostility, open hostility that we face from the Biden administration and internal subversion, the fact is that we are not having any difficulties defending ourselves against you, and we will take action. So I think that that was very important.
Absolutely. And especially so because one of the fault lines that this opposition effort to take down Benjamin Netanyahu's government was pursuing, and somewhat successfully, was trying to get the pilots and others in the Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, to stand down, not to, you know, respond to mobilization orders and the like. And this is very, very much the wrong signal to be sending at a moment like this. So let's hope that the Iranians are taking the right message from all of it. Carolyn, let me just turn quickly to one other topic. The woman who is now the coordinator for addressing the anti-Semitism problem, a woman by the name of Deborah Lipschitz, had a meeting the other day in which she involved a group called the Council on American Islamic Relations. And this is set in motion a wild controversy about how not just inappropriate that is, but how completely delusional. Because after all, the Council on American Islamic Relations, better known as CARE, its acronym, is a Muslim Brotherhood front organization that has been directly tied to Hamas in Israel and is, you know, to say the least, anti-Semitic through and through. Your thoughts on what Ms. Lipschitz has done here and her trying to rationalize it in the face of this
Deborah
intense
Lipstadt
criticism.
Deborah Lipstadt was appointed to be the envoy for the State Department for Combating Anti-Semitism. And on the eve of the Jewish festival of Shavuot, which is a major festival, when all of Israel was essentially offline for 3 days, she spoke at the White House with President Biden and other senior administration officials, where they presented their strategy for fighting anti-Semitism. And as you know, in the United States, American Jews are facing galloping levels, unprecedented levels of anti-Semitism throughout American society. And the most active and politically powerful force for anti-Semitism in the United States emanates from the progressive camp because of the support that they have and the power that they have in the Democratic Party. And so at this event, she did two things that were appalling. The first one was there is a definition that was passed by the International Association of Holocaust Scholars of anti-Semitism. They agreed on a resolution defining anti-Semitism 2016. That was adopted as the working definition of anti-Semitism, of contemporary anti-Semitism, by the State Department as well as by 40 other countries. And it defines Zionism, the Jewish National Liberation Organization, or anti-Zionism, as a form of anti-Semitism. And anybody who denies Israel's right to exist essentially is engaging in anti-Semitism because he's denying freedom and political self-determination to the Jewish people. So that's a form of anti-Semitism. And then in her definition, she also embraced not only the what's called the IHRA, I-H-R-A definition by its acronym of the organization, but also something called the Nexus definition of anti-Semitism, which is the exact opposite, that denying Israel's right to exist is not a form of anti-Semitism. So that was the first thing. So her strategy does not define anti-Semitism, which means it's not a strategy, it's a bluff. And it's a way of not combating anti-Semitism. It means that she's agreed not to do her job and to allow anti-Semitism to continue unopposed in the United States, which is enough of a disaster. But the second thing that she did that you alluded to was that they named CARE, a Hamas front organization in the United States that was an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land terror finance trial after the 9/11 attacks on the United States. She named them. They are one of the most powerful anti-Semitic organizations in the United States, specifically along the anti-Zionist and pro-terror, pro-murder of Israeli Jews line in America. And she named them as an implementing agency for the strategy that she presented when the largest Jewish community in the world, the Jewish community of Israel, was offline for a Jewish holy day. So what she has done is simply unacceptable and unforgivable.
Agreed.
Because at a time when American Jews gives the term useful idiot
a whole new meaning, doesn't it?
I don't even think she's a useful idiot. I think she's an actor here because she's supposed to be in charge of this. Well, why did she accept this position?
The trouble is that we're out of time to discuss this further today, but we will come back to you for more on it. I think this is
But to understand what she did, I mean, I think it's important to understand.
It should be a firing
offense.
She is
the envoy for enabling anti-Semitism in the United States.
This is her mission, I believe, under the Biden administration, which is all about it. We have to let you go. Thank you, Carolyn. Come back to us.
Thank you very much.
I hope the rest of you will do the same. Until then, go forth and multiply.